Call the House Judiciary, House Committee on the Judiciary to order. Today is the 28th of January, 2009. First item on the agenda is a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2323. Someone, if you could explain that for us.
House Bill 2323 would increase the value threshold in certain property crimes. It essentially is to keep in line with the cost of living increase.
Inflation.
Yeah. And is ready to be worked. There's no fiscal and no revenue impact.
Okay.
Are we 2323?
Call Gail Meyer and Brad Berry, may as well, if you're... Please.
I do have something to
both that you're both so in support of the bill, and just ask you to be sure and identify yourself and start speaking for the record and proceed in any order you wish.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gail Meyer, and I'm representing the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. It's a pleasure to be here today. House Bill 2323, we submit, is very clean, very lean, and very simple. It does really only one thing. It modifies property offenses by increasing the value threshold of the dollar distinction between the crimes. So by property crimes, I'm referring to theft, theft by receiving, theft of services, criminal mischief, and fraudulent use of a credit card. Those crimes are divided into classifications of seriousness based on the value of the property that was stolen or damaged or fraudulently obtained. And so misdemeanors are divided into A, B, and C misdemeanors, C being the least serious, and felonies into A, B, and C felonies. Again, C being the least serious. We're being passed out and a chart that shows the inflationary adjustment for these theft offenses that are being affected by this bill and also those that are not being affected by this bill. You'll see in the second column to the left the year amount that the dollar amount was last adjusted, and so in some instances the dollar figures have not been adjusted in years and in sometimes decades. The purpose of this bill is simply to keep the dollar distinction between the serious classifications of the crimes consistent with inflationary adjustment. Currently, the law has recognizes divisions between dollars that are less than 50, we would raise it to 100. Less than 750, we would raise that to 1,000. Greater than 750, then again, it would be greater than 1,000. As I stated initially, this is lean and clean. There's no other provision in this bill that would create any procedural differences, no new crimes, not... redefining crimes. It just simply adjusts the dollar value. It may have a very, very small fiscal positive in my view, because crimes that previously would have been charged as a felony might now be charged as misdemeanors with attendant less expenses in terms of appointed counsel and whatnot. So I don't believe there's any opposition from my colleague, but if there's any questions, I'd be happy to entertain them.
Are there any questions for now? Yes.
Just real quick. I would agree with the revenue fiscal impact being zero, but you would have to agree that by shifting, and I come about this via the fact that my local sheriff has contacted me, there is a cost shift potentially putting these cases to be dealt with rather than at the state level if they're convicted down at the county level. Yeah?
Yes. Some crimes that might be a felony might now by dollar value be adjusted downward to a misdemeanor, correct?
So I just didn't want anybody going thinking there was no, there is
yes.
No cost shift.
Yes, right.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Chair, two questions. First, is there something in this bill that indexes, and if not, should there be, right? And it could do it not every year necessarily, but every 5 years with using round numbers. First question. Second question, has there been any analysis about cost savings in these sort of challenging economic times that would that this would either create or prevent?
Okay. Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, there is no index in the bill. There never has been. I think we like the clear distinctions that we've always lived with. We used to live with $50, and then it was raised at one point to $75, and now we're raising it to $100. So I think it's accurate to say most practitioners like having those increments of $25 adjustments or $100 adjustments, because we just all go around in our heads knowing where the division line is. If they're an index, I think we might wonder what it was for that one given year. So if the inflationary rate continues to climb, you might see us again in several more years, but for now I think this is what we would like to see. So there is no index. Secondly, with respect to cost savings, again, that would there is potentially some. The practices vary county to county. In some counties, I know in Multnomah County, if you have a minimal prior record, and even if you don't, if you do get charged with a C misdemeanor, you might be immediately eligible for violation treatment, meaning that the district attorney would reduce the level of the crime from the beginning charging instrument to a violation, which is the functional equivalent of a traffic ticket, and from then you would not be entitled to court-appointed counsel. So the degree to which now, by adjustment, some of these offenses are treated less seriously, felonies might become C misdemeanors, or A misdemeanors rather, some C misdemeanors might become violations, there might be a cost savings there.
Thanks very much. The other thing I'd say is that if there were a way, with some bills that we're dealing with like this, to have stair-step indexes, it's not every year, you never deal with pennies, never even deal with single dollar amounts, but only with $100 amounts, $25 amounts, every 5-10 years, some mechanism, might be neat, based on a percentage of income, so it's always about the same. But you've already given a very good response, and thanks everybody for your time.
Thank you. And Representative Smith, this is these are brought to us in periodic times when it's shifted up, so we do those and like to make it very clear, bright line where those lines are. Mr. Berry.
Thank you. My name is Brad Berry. I'm the Yamhill County District Attorney, and I chair the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. The Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association first brought essentially this bill 4 years ago. We were basically in support with a minor change at that time. They came back 2 years ago with a similar bill. We asked for the same change, and they agreed to that. And now they're back this year with the same bill with the change already in it. And we've vetted this completely. We agree it's appropriate. Many of these numbers have been there for a long time. So the ODAA has been supportive in the past, and we're supportive of these changes. I might note a couple of things for you just based on the questions that are there. When we're talking about cost savings, there are a couple issues that will come up. One deals with probationers. Probationers on felonies currently are in the corrections budget. In other words, there is money that comes to the counties to pay for costs related to supervising convicted felons. There is no money from the state that comes to the counties for the purposes of supervising misdemeanants. And because of that, many counties do not have active supervision of misdemeanants. So insofar as you have that threshold of from $750 to $1,000 and you get caught in that small place, there would be a cost shift, I suppose, to the counties. But candidly, now speaking for my office, when we get close on these, we have an $800 loss, for example, today, we're going to err on the side of filing it as a misdemeanor anyway, so we don't end up in trial deciding whether or not the value of the loss was $749 or $750. And I don't think that we're particularly uncommon in that practice. We do occasionally get on the cusp and have to make decisions on what to do. So overall, I don't think that this will change many cases for many of us, and if it did, these are changes we might have made up front anyway.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Hey, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2323. Is there any more discussion about the bill?
Mr. Chair, I remember having this discussion with this bill, just like what Mr. Brett Berry mentioned about it 2-4 years ago, and actually I thought it made sense then, and that's how I feel about it today, too.
Okay, thank you. No further discussion. I'd accept a motion to move this to the, or pass this and send it to the consent calendar. It's kind of a non-issue.
Mr. Chair, I'll be voting no.
Okay, and we won't do that then. I'll accept a motion to send it to the floor.
So moved. With the new pass. Yeah. So moved.
Okay. Representative Sigler has moved. We send House Bill 2323 to the floor with a new pass. And if you'd call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
No.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Olson, if you'd carry that for us, please. Thank you. And thank you for the heads up, Representative Cameron. Appreciate that. Not too far along there. Next item on the agenda is we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2328. We do not have a fiscal back on that yet. If you're following these bills, you might note that 2328 and 2318 are identical, so we would just be hearing the one and not. I guess we could vote on both of them twice, but make it a little easier.
Mr. Chair, yes. Is there a possibility that we could hear both of them together, or at least I could provide testimony on 2318?
We'll just hear the one. Well, okay, we could do it either one, either bill. We'll hear them together. I'll open a public hearing also on 2318 as well as 2328. On this bill, I have Gail Meyer, Dan Rayfield, and Brad Berry again. And Representative Olson, you could, if you want to pull up a chair out there, you could. Please just identify yourself for the record and then proceed in any order you wish.
Thank you.
Representative Olson, would you like to go first, maybe?
Oh, well, yeah. Thank you,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Then you can come back and sit here.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Andy Olson, and happen to be a member of your committee here. This is truly a great opportunity to be in front of you. 2318 and 2328 are identical bills. And basically, in a nutshell version, the reason why I moved forward with 2318, it being a committee bill, is the problem that we have with an individual who gets arrested for driving under the influence of intoxicants. And that's where I really wanted to go with this. And let me paint the picture for you here. If tonight you drive home and you were partying a little bit and you decided that it was time to get home early, you get stopped by an officer and subsequently arrested for driving under the influence of intoxicants, you come back with a zero blood alcohol reading, and then also possibly a drug recognition expert, a DRE, comes in, does an evaluation on you, and determines that there's nothing wrong with you as well. That case right there goes to the district attorney's office, and they determine whether or not they're going to file it or not. If it's not filed, you still have this on your driving record. That's the problem, and that's the issue that I wanted to get fixed through this change here with this amendment, 2318, and that's basically what 2328 does as well. I have a father here in the back in the audience here. Mark Noakes has a son that has experienced this down in Linn County, but there's a number of other stories I can share with you, too, that a similar type incident throughout the state. Having talked about this a year ago with Bill Taylor here, he felt too it was an error and it was something that we needed to get corrected. So that's where we're at this time, and I'm just going to allow Gail here to share a little bit more from her perspective.
Before we go further, Representative Krieger.
Representative Olson, how many people did you arrest that came back .00? Quite a few, I'd imagine.
Mr. Chair.
As many as me, I hope.
Yeah. And Representative Krieger. You do that in front of one of my colleagues I came on the department with years ago.
I'll build you up later.
Anyways, I just don't recall, not too many.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I have to say that as a brand new baby lobbyist, it's really wonderful on your first day when your bills are set for hearing that on your right you should be joined by one of the committee members with an identical bill as your own. So I hope that when you think of my bill, which is 2328, you would have a visual image of Representative Olson sitting here by my side with an identical bill. Basically, the expungement statute has always exempted municipal and state traffic crimes and traffic arrests from being eligible to be expunged. And we're hoping today to correct the injustice, really, of splicing that in half. Convictions are not being addressed by our bill. So if you are convicted of DWI or you are convicted of a traffic or municipal traffic crime, that is not being impacted by this bill. What this bill does is it allows the court to expunge the arrest for a municipal and state traffic offense. And so if a charging instrument is filed and then ultimately dismissed, or if one is never filed, or if it's filed, you go to trial, and you are acquitted, then you would have the opportunity and privilege of applying to the court for permission to expunge that arrest. What we do, and we did this really in deference to opposition from the District Attorneys Association, I think, quite frankly, it's legitimate. What's not impacted by this bill is if you would be arrested for DWI, and then you go through a diversion program, and then as a result of the diversion, you get the case dismissed, that will stay on your record. That is not eligible to be expunged. And so basically we're looking for those cases that were really not good cases. They weren't good arrests. The district attorney didn't file. He filed and then he or she looked at it and ultimately chose to dismiss it. Or there was an acquittal. So it's those kind of cases that really were not legitimate in terms of being subject to conviction that are being impacted here. They do have, these arrests do have long-term consequences. On my left, your right, is attorney Dan Rayfield. He practices with an 8-membered firm in Albany. He has several clients who have been impacted here through this inability to expunge arrests. He's got one client who is the son of Mark Noakes, who is also present in the courtroom, who was arrested by an officer. He did blow a 00 when he got to the station, and he did do urine testing, and it came up zero for presence of controlled substances, and he's been impacted with a DWI arrest that he cannot get off his record. So I would be happy to answer any questions from the committee, but otherwise I might suggest that that you might want to hear from Mr. Rayfield at this time.
And this is a hearing room, not a courtroom. But
did I say that? I'm so sorry.
Please go ahead.
Thank you.
So at times we lapse into those.
Mr. Chair, I hope someday I don't call you Your Honor. That could happen too. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Dan Rayfield, and as you heard, I am an attorney for several clients who have arrests on the record that cannot be expunged, and I'll tell you a little bit about those. One thing you know that you want to also remember is that the people that I represent, there's a whole bunch of countless stories out there of people who don't have cases that I would bring. The cases I bring are in situations where I believe that you know there wasn't probable cause to make an arrest. There was a constitutional violation. There's different ways that you know this can affect us as you know drivers on the road. You know there's different causes. For instance, a negligence of an officer. Now I admit you know Representative Krieger pointed out very well, you know, how often does someone get arrested with a 00? I would admit that that doesn't happen as often, but it does happen. There's also an error factor. The standardized field sobriety tests, when they're conducted, they are not 100% accurate. So even an officer is performing the duty exactly as they should, there's going to be times when they're still going to make an error, and there's nothing we can do about that. And then there's also subsequent evidence that might come to the attention of the officer later on. So you make a decision to arrest, and at that point, let's say it's a reckless driving, and they use circumstantial evidence to be able to determine that this person, and there was probable cause. Later on, there's a video of this individual driving, and maybe it turns out to be ICE or something like that, where it doesn't meet the level of a reckless driving. That arrest is permanently on the record. You know, and then also in very rare instances, there's also the malicious actions of a police officer. And I obviously would, you know, well admit that it's very rare, but it does happen. And what are the damages to these individuals? And I can kind of go through four of my clients. Three of them are very young. Most of them are, one's in community college. One actually is graduated. He's young, about 25. He's an accountant. Then you have another one who's still in college here at Oregon State University. And then you have one who's a nurse. And how does this affect each of them in their daily lives? You have an FBI record that has now been created. All these individuals now have an FBI record. That FBI record points to the law enforcement data system. Within that law enforcement data system, they now have a criminal record there. Who has access to this file? And that is, public records. I mean, I'm sure we're all aware of how that gets accessed. So anytime a police officer pulls somebody over, they have access to know they have been arrested at some point for a DUI. And any time that, you know, you have to fill out on an insurance application, Brian Noakes, on his life insurance application, they want to know what type of behavior is this individual engaged in. It says, have you ever been arrested? And there's also a separate section, have you ever been convicted? They consider those separately. You press, yes, this is a, if someone gets arrested for a DUI, I would submit an insurance company looking at that, thinks, well, this person's involved in some risky behavior, and that's a factor that they're going to consider. Another thing, Lance Briggs, one of my other clients, he went to Canada, and he was detained at the border for over 2 hours at that point because of just an arrest. Now, Lance Briggs pulled over, and for whatever reason, he was arrested. He blew a 0.000. There was absolutely no indications of drug use. In fact, he submitted to a urine sample, which came back negative as well. At that point, that arrest is permanent. There was nothing to do. The district attorney, shortly days afterwards, said that we're not going to pursue this. And yet he gets detained at the border for 2 hours because there's an open record on there that says an arrest, and there's nothing he can do about that. That is a permanent scar on his record. You go on, employment. So, and different types of employment applications. Now, even private employers may not have access to this information, but when Brian Noakes or when Lance Briggs goes to apply for a job and it says, have you ever been arrested? They must check yes. Even though they know that they're probably never going to get access to those records, in a situation like that, you kind of find yourself caught in a goofy situation. I can surely click no on that box. But at that point, you still risk. You're not being honest at that point. And so they've got an arrest on the record that wasn't valued. How does that really affect them? Well, and I would submit as an employer, you've got two equal applications. I mean, great applicants both ways. One of them has a clean application, no arrest. The other has, yes, see attached, and it's got, a letter from the DA, which would be very rare, and then you might have the police report and, and no action or something on the bottom of that. As an employer, think if you're working, let's say, your rental car agency where, there's driving involved or things like that, you got to look at that. Now, most of us being, pretty level-headed, we understand, we're more educated about this process. A lot of people wouldn't do that. In fact, I have people who are willing to testify, actually, in upcoming trials that, in fact, if there was an arrest on the record, they would indeed not hire that individual and go with the person with the clean record. And that is a permanent record for the rest of them. Now you have to look at if they apply for public jobs. You apply for the CIA, the FBI. I mean, the list goes on. All these different things. You must disclose this information. And so those are just some of the, they go on and on. I mean, the different ways, there's a huge stigma of having a DUI arrest. I mean, that's a pretty substantial matter. And, so I respectfully ask that you do pass the bill.
Thank you. Are there any questions? That was very
concise explanation. Really appreciate that. Mr. Berry.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I am Brad Berry again, Yamhill County District Attorney and Chair of the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. We're in support of this bill. Actually, I think all of us have at one time or another, and I haven't since this past week, had a case come in where someone's been arrested on a DUI, and we know we don't file it. We do a prosecution decline, and I concur that this limited expansion of the right to set aside record of arrest is appropriate in those cases. I should point out this goes to traffic crimes, not to other traffic violations. They're not included in the definition. The two things I do want to point out, because you may have similar issues coming back before you, I mentioned to Ms. Meyer that the District Attorneys Association is really interested in looking at the overall bill of the overall law, which allows setting aside of convictions. It's rather hodgepodge. It's been changed over and over to allow and not allow things through the years, and currently has some really odd, from our perspective, some odd provisions. For example, in some cases, you may be able to set aside a conviction of a domestic violence assault, wherein we know now that actually a prior conviction of a domestic assault against the same victim would be a felon, and would be a felony if you did it again. So we allow them to set it aside. We can't use it on the one hand, and on the other, we've recognized doing it again should become a felony. So there are many of those things that we recognize are issues which should be dealt with, and our hope is to convene a work group to look at, as I mentioned to Ms. Miner, what can we agree on that should be you can't set aside, what will we disagree on, and then go from there. But it really is something that needs a broader view. Lastly, and I think it's important that the record reflect this, we often, and I include the lawyers in my office, we use the term expunge. And expungement does not exist except in the juvenile court system. It is setting aside record of arrest or conviction, which is covered by this particular statute. Again, expungement is kind of shorthand, but they are different legal things. And I just want to be sure that the record is clear. We're not intending to create something that really isn't the intention here. This would allow for a motion to set aside record of arrest for a traffic crime is what this does.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions?
I'd just like to comment that I'm glad you brought that up, because that was going to be one of my questions, to clarify that this in the adult system it's a very different process, and it really has different ramifications than does the expungement in the juvenile process. So thank you.
Okay, further questions? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just one other thing, too. Some try to clear this up a little bit about what's going on with the fiscal on this bill as well, because that needs to be addressed here. Yesterday, I received fiscal on 2318 that came back somewhere in the neighborhood of between $10,000 to $200,000. Having talked with a number of DAs around the state, they were kind of surprised that it was even that high, and couldn't see why it would be much of a fiscal at all. And I was just curious if maybe, you know, Mr. Berry might speak to that point.
If you could,
Chair Barker, members of the committee. Let me share, if I can, briefly what our process is currently when we receive a request to set aside record of arrest or conviction. In our building, in the Yamhill County Courthouse, anybody with those questions, even to the court, is sent to our office, and we have a packet that we provide for them, which basically sets forth what the law is, which types of record can and cannot be set aside. The person inquiring then would fill out the paperwork. It's very simple. It's made to be user-friendly, so you don't need an attorney. And they return that with a set of fingerprints and a check to the Oregon State Police to run a records check. We review that, send it off to OSP, and while that happens, it's assigned to one of my deputies who will review it. And candidly, it's a checklist. You either qualify or you don't on it. And those cases where we believe that somebody qualifies and we get the response from OSP that, in fact, they have no further convictions, we prepare a stipulated order that is forwarded to the court to give to a judge, signed off, and it's over. There is some expense related there that the court order then needs to be sent to any agency that would have a record of that particular arrest or conviction so that they are all sealed. So there is that, and of course the courts have to enter this. The only other time, though, that comes up that I'm aware of is where we object to a request to set aside, and we do that based on the statute. The statute says you can or you can't. If it says you cannot, then we object to it, and a person requesting it may want a hearing, and I've been to those hearings. instance where somebody comes in and it's, well, gee, this doesn't seem right. I've been a good guy for the last X number of years, and this was a mistake, and I think everybody's sympathetic, but the statute does not allow the court to do that. So it is the rare circumstance, at least in our county, that this matter would ever be set for a hearing, and I candidly can't recall a contested hearing in the sense that witnesses are being called and the like, although I could see where it happened. There may be some dispute on the record, but that would be very rare.
Yes. Mr. Chair, if I might add one other comment about that. The only person really motivated to seek an expungement of a traffic arrest is someone with a clean record. So if you were to look at all of the statistics of traffic arrests that are not prosecuted and result in conviction, that will not necessarily result in the same number of people seeking expungement of those arrests, because many of those individuals have already multiple offenses or traffic crimes on their record and they won't seek it. So it's for that person who has a clean record who will be motivated to file and seek for expungement. So you can't simply look at statistics relating to arrests that do not result in conviction and think that that would translate to the same number of expungements, because I don't think it would relate at all.
Okay. And again, we're not talking about expungements, right?
Setting aside.
Thank you.
Very different.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's important. As we establish a record, you know, if something goes to the appellate court, we want to make clear that that's what we're talking about.
Yes. Okay.
So, okay. Thank you very much, Pam.
Thank you.
I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2328 and 2318. We'll move 2318 forward when we get a fiscal on it. We'll have a work schedule work session. Thank you. The next item on the agenda is a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2357. Could you give us a brief explanation, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
House Bill 2357 clarifies who inherits, if a person disclaims their right to inherit property passing by intestate succession. There is no fiscal and no revenue on this, so we'll move forward.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Moore.
Parker, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Moore. I'm an attorney with the law firm Soffield Griggs here in Salem, Oregon. And I'm representing and testifying on behalf of the Oregon State Bar Estate Planning and Administrative Section regarding this in support of House Bill 2357. The reason we're supporting this is because Oregon, back in 2001, adopted the Uniform Disclaimer Act that had been drafted in 1999. In 2003, that Uniform Law Act Committee suggested some clarifications to the law, and they had proposed that all states who had enacted the law enact those clarifications. Oregon has not yet done that, so this is somewhat of a technical correction to clarify some of those issues. To explain, disclaimer in estate planning is basically a legal no thank you to property that you would normally receive. And so then the question then comes, well, who does receive that property if you say no thank you? Well, the law in Oregon currently provides that it just goes according to the instrument of the estate plan. The problem that is created or that's unclear at this point is what if there was not an estate plan? So the law addresses if there was a trust or a will and so forth, and the law provides that if you say no thank you, then it just passes on to the next beneficiary named in the instrument. But in a case where there is no estate plan, or what's called intestate succession, Oregon has a series of laws that says this is who it passes to in a series, and ultimately the state's at the end of the line. Well, this bill is meant to clarify that so that it falls into the category that if something is disclaimed, it would fall into the category similar to what if the instrument itself had not provided something. If the instrument is silent on the disclaimer, then it generally will pass to the descendants of the disclaimant by representation, which is deemed the typical estate plan of most people. So that's the default that Oregon law has already established. And so the idea is to clarify that similarly in intestate succession that it would likewise pass to descendants. In addition, there's one other clarification in a situation where If I break down the two situations, basically you have a will or an instrument, which would control, or you have no will or instrument, intestate succession. If it does pass under intestate, it provides those rules that would go to descendants by representation, if that's what the default law provides. And currently that's what Oregon does. But if it is to pass to the estate of the disclaimant, the law is silent. So there is no series of people that it would trickle down to. It just simply says the estate. Well, in the case of the estate, you've got some problems as to where does this property go. This bill clarifies that if it were to go to the estate of the disclaimant, and again, very similar to most estate plans, it would just likewise to the existing Oregon default rules pass down to the descendants of the disclaimant by representation. And this is particularly helpful when we're talking about a future interest. And what I mean by that is normally somebody, if they inherit, they get it right away. But there may be a situation where somebody says, my son gets it for a period of his life, and then it is to pass on to my dear friend. Well, if the friend says, no, I really can't accept that. It should pass to your family or whatever. Or I want it to go to my own children. That person disclaims it at the time of the testator's death. But what happens is, because it's a future interest, it ultimately will pass back to that friend's estate when son does die. The problem with that is that for tax purposes, if an individual says, no thank you, I don't want it part of my estate, I've got an estate tax problem, they say no thank you. But if it reverts back to the estate many years later, perhaps, of that person who disclaimed, it's now back into their estate for estate taxation, unlike what they really anticipated or wanted. And so in that situation, this bill also clarifies that it would pass to the descendants of the disclaimant. So it's out of their own estate, passes according to what most estate plans would do. If they don't have any descendants, it would go back to the person who was giving the property, back to their intestate descendants. And that's generally the bill in a nutshell. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you very much. That is some good examples there. Help make
okay.
it clear.
Appreciate
Thank you.
That.
We're ready to move, right? Yeah. There's okay. no fiscal. Okay. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2357. Open a work session on House Bill 2357.
All I can say is I'm glad it was he who was explaining.
Chair, I move House Bill 2357 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Could we move this one to the consent calendar? Is there any objection to that?
Okay. On the consent calendar.
Okay, thank you. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Yes.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. And we put on a consent calendar because I don't want to have to try to explain that on the floor.
You could have Mr. Barton.
Yeah, he's doing enough. Is there any further business to come before the committee?
Mr. Chair, question on 2187.
Yes, I'm sorry, we skipped that one. I mean, there is that. We're still going to do that.
Oh, okay, thanks.
That I have it boxed out because of the other thing here. Thank you.
Phew.
Open a public hearing on House Bill 2187. And we have a... Mr. Cox, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Ms. Philip Cox, Assistant Director of the Youth Authorities Program Office.
I'm here today representing Interim Director Bobby Mink to testify in support of House Bill 2187, which was introduced by the Governor on behalf of the Youth Authority. House Bill 2187 is proposed by the Youth Authority to receive explicit statutory authority to require fingerprint background checks on prospective foster care providers and adult members of foster care applicant households. Chapter 420A of the Oregon Revised Statutes, which created the Youth Authority, provides the agency with specific authority to require fingerprint background checks on employees, applicants for employment, vendors, volunteers, and contractors. It doesn't directly authorize the agency to require fingerprint background checks for prospective foster care providers or adult members of their households. Historically, the agency has conducted background checks on these persons as contractors and under the authority of ORS 181.534, which speaks to the authority of authorized agencies to require fingerprint criminal background checks of subject individuals. We believe that this bill, House Bill 2187, will remove ambiguity that currently exists in statute by explicitly giving the agency authority to require fingerprint background checks of foster care applicants and adult members of their households. We consider this primarily a housekeeping bill. Mr. Chair, I'd be pleased to answer any questions that committee members might have.
Representative Krieger. We had an inquiry as to, in three, the last part, that member of the applicant's household, who the concern was, would this mean a 14-month-old baby, an 8-year-old? What are we going to do with that part of that applicant?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, the intention is that this would apply to adult members of the household. The intention basically is when you have a foster care applicant and they are, say, a member of a man and his wife. The wife might be the applicant. The husband is a member of the household. And so the intention is that it's for adult persons, not for minors.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Then we need to get an amendment to state it?
Absolutely. Happy to do that, sir.
Any further questions? Okay, thank you. And we will look for an amendment to clarify that. Ms. Meyer, would you like to...
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU. Thank you. I was able to chat with a few folks, and Representative Krieger was one of them, and I have concerns about the scope of the definition or the lack of definition in line 12. Just briefly, as way of background, criminal history background checks using the fingerprints and sending them to the FBI has been a concern of the ACLU, and Representative Cameron could talk to everyone extensively about the legislation in 2005 that was 65 pages, and we thought we got everyone in terms of agencies and boards. And one of the aspects of creating the statutory scheme to give authority, and we're very concerned about the increasing sort of expansion of the authority, is elsewhere in the law it requires that then agencies by rulemaking or licensing boards ensure that they list the types of crimes and the types of nexus between the crimes, how long ago, and the type of employment. Someone who's applying for a job to handle money, so there might be concern about fraud and other issues in their past, but was busted for pot 20 years ago, wouldn't necessarily be a strong basis or even a basis at all to deny them the employment. So we don't want to have a situation where you have a criminal history, you don't get a job. What I have not had a chance to do, but I'm now quite concerned, and I want to raise this, there are, I think, 6 fingerprint bills so far in this building. Representative Cameron, there's actually more bills. One is in agriculture in this side, and I think the rest are over on the Senate. It'd be ideal to get one committee to look at them. But what I haven't had a chance to do extensively, but what I've seen so far, I'm concerned about is some of these agencies are really not doing the rules correctly. And one sent me a draft of their rules, and I didn't have a chance to look at it before they finalized them, but I emailed them and said, you're writing in statute that the types of crimes are listed in our policy manual. Oh, and the nexus in the evaluation, it's listed in our policy manual. Well, you can't do that. It's supposed to be in rulemaking. I mean, ideally, it would be in statute, but we've let left it to agencies. So I'm very concerned, and I just want to give you the context when we start about expanding. So that's sort of the big picture. These are these incremental pieces that are coming forward, and I'm concerned. I appreciate that it's limited to adult member, but I'm not sure still how we define how someone is a member of an applicant's household, what that means, who would be swept into it, and I would rather give them more limited authority than broad authority, and who decides. I mean, I heard the testimony, it's husband and wife. Well, that's easy. Maybe they're both listed there as that's where they're residents of and their address, but I don't know what defines a member of a household. So I raise that. And the other thing I want to raise in light of actually the hearing you were, the bills before, was that in OIA's rules, which are extensive and include other things, they do actually want to look at someone's arrest record for a number of crimes, including drug and alcohol offenses. And that worries us in terms of having that be part of the picture. I, you know, get convictions and all those other things, but when we start looking at arrests, we sometimes run into trouble. So I want to highlight that. It's a great project for someone to, and not me yet, to look at all the rules that have been put in place by all the agencies about whether they've really truly complied in the last 4 years. So I would ask that an amendment be done to clarify adult, but then I'm not sure where we're left in terms of really what the scope of that is in terms of member of household.
Okay, and what we're looking at is the foster homes that are taking youth offenders who are a particularly vulnerable citizen, and you know, we've had some horrific stories in the past of people who signed on to help these kids who've just done horrendous things, and the Oregon Youth Authority is trying to correct that and really make sure that when they assign a child, a youth, not necessarily a child, out to one of these foster homes, that it is a good place when it's a home where they're, so that they'll hopefully progress out of the system and not just in a vicious circle, and I'm sure you're aware of that.
And Chair Barker, yeah, I'm not here committee testifying that we oppose this and there's no justification for this inclusion. That's not what I'm doing. And there may be some situations where some agencies or folks do expand this, and I might come in and oppose that. I'm not. I'm aware and sensitive to the issue, but I want agencies that already have a lot of discretion to know by statute the meaning of these words and to be clear so that when someone says, when someone's told to be a foster parent in that household, you need to have a criminal history done with your fingerprints, they can look at the law and clearly understand that that's them or that's not them, and what that means. You want everyone to not be fighting over what is a member of a household. And I don't know if there's definition elsewhere in the law.
Sure.
We'll have the amendment should clarify that. Mr. Garrett.
I kind of assume the intention was to get at everybody who resides at that address. If the bill were amended to state that expressly, would that solve your problem?
Chair Barker, Representative Garrett, I think that would go a long way. Residing at the address is a little bit more legal term, I think, in terms of folks understanding proof of residency and where they reside. And that may go a long way to not just over 18 or 18 and over, but also that reside.
That's what we're looking for, something concise. And that's what we'll hope to hopefully bring back in an amendment, something that makes sense to everybody and makes it clear to the people who are subjected to that.
Yes.
Any further questions?
We get the calls from people who are subjected to it.
Yeah.
Like, what do you mean?
Any further questions? No further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2187 and not open a work session until we get the amendment back. Chance to do that. Now, with no further business before.
On this?
There's a minimal. So there won't.
No further business for the committee. Committee's adjourned. 11 on the 30.